The date today is the 25th of July 2018. I'm an oral interview with Mrs. Peggy Carter. Peggy, would you like to tell me what your full name is, please?
Just Margaret Carter.
Do you have a second name?
No, I haven't. My maiden name was McIntosh, and it was long enough without a second name.
Now, last month you actually had a very special occasion. Would you like to tell me what that was?
Well, on the 17th of June 1918, I was born, and so I was 100 years old.
It's pretty special, isn't it?
Well, people seem to be making a big fuss over it. I think it's one of those things you just got to accept, the same as you accept any other birthday.
That's well said. Peggy, can you tell me, did you have some parties? Did you have lots of people come and see you?
Well, we had on the Saturday, all the immediate family had lunch at Diane and Roger Hall's place at Havelock North. And then on the Sunday morning, as well as my family being there, quite a few of my friends, my long-time friends, unfortunately have all gone before me, but there were quite a number of friends, came from 10 to 12, and they had morning tea and a glass of champagne and generally socialised. And most of my friends were from various occupations. I was wondered how they would all communicate with each other. There were, besides the family, there was my doctor, my hairdresser, and friends from, retired from work. But anyway, they all introduced themselves, and I had some students there, great-granddaughters who are at the, I think, the Dunedin University, Otago University. They've got granted a very substantial scholarship to study medicine about growing parts of your body, say your nose has come off, about how they can grow a new nose for you, perhaps attaching it to your ear. And as my doctor was there, she was very interested in all this research work that my great-granddaughters are doing. So there was a real mixture of people, from students right up to, there was nobody else there, 100, but they might have been in their 80s. It was quite a happy morning tea, and they were all surprised to get a glass of champagne to wish me many long years ahead.
I think that's really quite special. And Peggy, you actually don't get a telegram from the Queen anymore, but tell me what you got and from whom you got recognition.
There was a photo of the Queen, a very nice photo. There was one from the Prime Minister, which I was rather surprised, because I have never been a great Labour supporter, so it was rather a surprise. And there was one from the Governor-General, and who else was there? Anyway, that's about all I can think of, but we can get them out later and you can look at the lot if you like.
That's really very good, isn't it? Peggy, what I'm going to do now is take you back in time 100 years to when you were born. Would you like to tell me whereabouts you were born and who your parents were, for example? Grandparents, maybe?
My father came home from the war early, Alec McIntosh, because in Egypt he'd got malaria, and he was invalided home from the First World War, and my mother and he were married, I presume it was in Tai Happy, and then when I was on the way, Mum wanted to go over and stay with her mother, and my grandfather, who was working on a station at Mohonga, and so, but my mother had to ride out. They were. My father drew a block in a soldier settlement block, and the original property had belonged to the Bees, and they had actually a lot of land up around Cotamari and Puterino. At one time I had all the data about the land at Puterino when there used to be a land office in Napier, but some of the family have all the data about those subdivisions for the returned soldiers, and anyway I stayed with my mother stayed with her parents, and I was born in Taihape. Well, then I presume I came home, but there weren't any houses like they did for the Second World War. They had to split their own timber, fell the totara trees, and a lot of the timber for the wharre that they built had to be all pit sawn. And I can't remember, but my mother says that one of the first things I did as soon as I could walk around was put my foot in a billy of boiling water. But of course, you couldn't go to the doctor, or I suppose you could have if you liked to ride 60 miles. But I dare say we ended up with five siblings, and I dare say over our growing up time we fell out of trees and did all sorts of things, and tripped over, and I can remember the minister coming out, and he used to stay the night, and because he used to have to ride out to our place. There were no roads, there were only bridle tracks, and I can remember my mother saying, well, take Mr. Dysart. He ended up at head of the Presbyterian Church. Down the native bush, we had a lot of native bush, and my brothers and I were taking him, and he fell over a supplejack. He wasn't used to bush, and he fell over the supplejack running around, and he shot down the gully, and John and I couldn't help but laugh. And even when we were growing up, we always called it Dysart's Gully. and then we used to get the mail about, could get it once a week or once a fortnight, and we used to ride out to the Puterino post office, and my father had came from Scotland, and we always used to get a Scottish newspaper that he was interested in, I never used to mind riding, but I seemed to be the only brave one about that. Our next door neighbour was 7 or 8 miles away, and I used to ride to their place, and I remember saying, well, I'm always riding to your place, why don't you ride to mine? And she said, my mother won't let me in case I fall off. And I said, well, doesn't it matter if I fall off? But I've never been afraid of anything, like, you know, you're getting on a horse never worried me or anything like that, or doing anything new. But I was a bit late starting school. I was nearly 7, and my father used to ride with me into the school on Monday morning and ride home on the Friday night after school. But for that year, I used to board with a couple that had no children, and as I say, go home on the Friday night. That was because the education system was changing. Everybody had learned ABCD and was changing to ABCA, and Mum was going to start teaching John, my brother next to me, and me by correspondence school. I It was actually in the first decade of puberty at the correspondence school. And anyway, then we had correspondence school. Jim, my third in the family, was coming up, and he was rather a slow learner. And I think Mum thought it was going to be a bit too much like hard work of teaching three of us kids. So my father then bought 300 acres in near Puterino and built a new house on this. And by this time I was about 12. And we then went to school there, and we had to walk about 3 miles over up, well, what was the bridle track. Then we sat for our proficiency exam. In those days, you had to get your proficiency exam to get free tuition at high school, or you could get the competency exam, which you could go to the technical college. But being up in the country, you had to go to boarding school. So it meant that the boys and girls went to boarding school. So I went to the Napier Girls. Oh, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. I was still at Puterino, and we had a seventh form because it was acceptable during the slump, because so many of the farmers' children couldn't afford to go to school. But we were a bit more fortunate than most, in so much that my grandmother, McIntosh in Scotland, had left money for our education. But on the morning the earthquake struck, I was in school inside. Most of the kids were out, but I was in the senior class, and we got outside, and a lot of the kids used to come to school on horses. But the horses went mad. They were galloping round and round the horse paddock. And Miss Milne, our teacher, wasn't used to horses. And she said to me, "Peggy, you're good at horses. You go out and catch those horses for the kids who've got to get home." So I went out and I caught the horses. But I didn't know which saddle and bridle belonged to which horse. I knew which horse belonged to which kid. But the kids were all over the place, way up the road. And anyway, they were rounded up and brought home and told me which was their horse. Well, I knew which was the horses, but which was their saddle and bridles. And I saddled them up and set them off home. And one of the families was the Scott family, and they had to go right down the coast road. And we ourselves, the East Coast Railway was going through at that time. At the time of the earthquake, it ceased working, but a truck from the public works camp came to pick up the public works children that were at school. That was the time when the highest role, so I was told, has ever been at the Puterino school, when the children from the public works camp were there. Anyway, they sent a lorry around to pick up the public works kids, and I don't know, I suppose there were about four of us. We all went home with them because they had to pass our place to get down to the viaduct. But I can remember the road had opened up and there's a great big cracks and that. Then after we got home, the chimney was down, and Mum had preserved dozens of bottles of fruit, and it was all over the... And I remember we had to bring in a wheelbarrow and a spade and shovel. And John and I shoveled all this broken glass and food into the wheelbarrow. And of course the water tanks all came down, because we in our homestead depended on rainwater. And we had two big tanks. And I can remember you used to go round and tap on them to see how much water you had left in them. You could tell by the sound. But anyway, we must have recovered from the earthquake eventually. I remember we had to cook outside, and we had a camp oven. But in those days, we always had to make our own bread, our own butter, and it wasn't so easy. And I expect there was somebody working for us that had to be fed. And it wasn't so easy cooking on a camp oven. Then I went away to the Napier Girls High School. I was a boarder there. I did quite well at school. the last year I was there, I got 8 prizes, which was more prizes than anybody else got in the school. And we had Mr. Bernard was invited. It was the Labor government. It was the first time the Labor government had been in power. And he was a member for Napier, and he'd been invited to the Napier Girls High School to present the prizes. Anyway, I wasn't very impressed with him. He had a very beery smelling breath, and he seemed half drunk. And when I came up for my last prize, he said, "I think I've seen you before, haven't I?" And then after I left school, I went home. But in those days, you sort of stayed home and helped at home, both in the house and on the farm where you were needed. But one day somebody came across over home and said that they needed somebody in the post office. Would I come and help them? And anyway, I went and I worked in the post office for a while, and it was also the telephone exchange, and you had to see the right people got connected up. Well, I worked in there for a while, and I remember being commended from Napier that it was one of the best run sub post offices in Hawke's Bay. I've always been very careful with my bookwork. Then I got married and had 3 children, and my husband went to the war, and he was killed at the war, and so I was a war widow with 3 children. Then I moved to Napier and bought myself a house.
You said you got married. What was your husband's name?
Richard Francis Sturm. He was killed in Libya.
And you said you had 3 children. What
were
their names?
3 children. Malcolm, he's just recently died. He was a barrister and solicitor here in Napier. And Margaret was the oldest, and she's Margaret Clark these days.
And, of course, your daughter Diane.
Yeah, then Diane. She never saw her father. Well, it was a fairly long, dreary time at the war. My brothers went to the war, and one thing and another. And then when the war was over, well, I married Carter. They used to farm at Puterino too. And of course, we thought or hoped we'd get a farm in the Ballot, because they were running Ballots for Return Cert, and he was working for his father on his father's farm. But we never got a Ballot. And well, we thought, well, if we wanted a farm, our accountant had said the town milk industry was a good thing to get into, because at the end of the war, the towns were all very short of milk, and what milk there was wasn't very healthy. A lot of the herds were very bad with TB, and the TB testing came in, and the whole of the milk industry was turned around. They had a separate lot of farmers, dairy farmers. You had nothing to do with the ordinary seasonal milking, because you had to have a quota of so many gallons a day, so that the authorities knew how much milk you could produce and how much they needed for every town. And our accountant said to us, that was a good thing to get into, because you made a lot more milk being town milk. They had to pay you for the extra feed you had to have during the winter, and you were working in worse conditions because you were having to milk through May, June, July and August, and you had to be reimbursed so that there would be enough people to supply enough milk, and therefore they had to pay you a bit more than the ordinary seasonal milkers. And well, that was all right. So we thought, well, how the hell are we going to make enough money to buy a farm? Because farms have always been just about out of everybody's reach. And Dick bought a milk round. You had to buy the milk round from the city council. They used to, I think they were about $2,000 just for the right to deliver milk. And then you had to buy a truck, and then you usually had quite a few boys. There were subsidies on the milk that you supplied to the boarding schools and the hospitals, and there was quite a lot of bookkeeping with that. And we had a dairy as well, and I worked in that. And there was somebody working in our house from 1 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock at night to buy our own farm. Well, eventually we bought a farm at Miani. We had to borrow money. Mr. Fabian was our solicitor at that time, Mason Dillon Fabian, and he managed to borrow some money from the Church of England. And anyway, we got into our farm with a big mortgage, and well, we didn't know much about, well, both of us had been brought up on beef and sheep farms. We sort of knew all about that. But Town Milk was a separate entity altogether that was sort of, well, the secretary of the milk producers in Napier said, oh, well, ask some of these farmers. But every farmer told you a different story, so you didn't know where you were. But the ag department was very good, and we got quite friendly with most of them. But I was putting money into the farm, and I said to Mr. Fabian, well, at the end of the war, women were still pretty much second-rate citizens. They were considered not to have any brains, and, you know, you were pretty low class, if you know what I mean. And I said to Mr. Fabian, well, a lot of this money is my money, because I'd got some from the McIntosh estate, and I'd always been careful with what money I had. I always saved every penny I got. And he said, well, the best plan for me to do is to make it into a company. So we made it into a company, and we called it Latona Farm Limited. It's got their Latona Friesian. And Dick was, when we bought it, and it was in October, I don't know what year now, and Dick was going out to learn the cows, and then he came home one night and he said, Mrs. Catton says there's a few pedigrees, and it always costs you money to transfer pedigree stock, but she said she'd transfer the for nothing if we were interested. Well, Dick came home and he said about these pedigrees, and I said, well, if it's not going to cost us anything, we may as well have them. And he says, well, he said, there's always a lot of work with pedigree stock. He says, you'll have to do the work. And I said, right. He said, well, you're the stud master. And as I say, it all happened sort of like that. And anyway, we took a couple of yearlings to the show and won, and that sort of set us going. We didn't expect it, but we both had a good eye for stock. And so now, how did it go? Well, I ended up being a stud master, and then somebody else, some of the other farmers in Miani, we didn't actually know them, but they must have, you know, how people talk. And one of them came and said to me, well, we believe you're quite a good bookkeeper. Would you be the secretary for the Hawke's Bay branch? Well, Hawke's Bay stood from about Wire or down to Dannevirke, and it was quite a large area. And, well, I said, well, I suppose I can be, but I don't really know anything about it. Anyway, so I was secretary. Well, I ended up being secretary for 21 years for Hawke's Bay. And then they cut out the autumn show, and somebody said, why don't we have something like a field day to take the place of the autumn show? Well, they said, oh, well, our secretary can arrange that. But there was a lot of work in arranging, you know, who you were going to have exhibiting, the judges, and all sorts of things. And anyway, we had our first field day, and it went very well. And one of the competitions we had was sort of leadership in leading your animals, ring craft, they called it. And I remember I won the ring craft. Well, I was a bit lucky there, because I started off leading one of my own. But then the people in charge said, swap animals. And I swapped with, and it happened to be another one of ours that I taught to lead. So anyway, I won that competition. And the judges of the day from Auckland said, what's Dick going to say when you get home, Mrs. Carter? I said, he'll just say, what a mug lot of judges there were on today. Well, I arranged quite a lot of these field days on different farms and Kaupo Monastery, and I encouraged a lot of young people into pedigree farms and generally, and then in their wisdom, the Friesian Board gave me this. And I was the first woman in New Zealand to get that award. Since then, there are a number of women who got that award. And then with the judging competitions, all the farmers were a conservative lot and still thought that if you were a woman, you didn't know anything about farming. And we always ran a judging competition. So I thought, well, I'll fix that. And then we always had proper cardboard sheets put out by the Young Farmers Club, I think. And instead of putting the person's name at the top, I put numbers. If you were the first one, I put Kevin, and I keep a master sheet with number one. It meant that the senior judges from all over New Zealand couldn't automatically pick out a man's name. And I myself began to win quite a lot of the judging competitions. So the Auckland lot, the results all went to Auckland head office, and after a while they thought, well, there's a woman winning in the judging competition, but we haven't got any woman judges. So I was made a judge, and still women weren't very welcome. They were quite rude at times. I can remember at one stage being up at Wangaree at the annual meeting for the Holstein Friesian Association and sitting at the table with Bernie Kyle and Mrs. Kyle, and Mrs. Kyle saying to me, was I going to the annual meeting? And I said, yes, I was. And she said, well, how did I go to the annual meeting? And I said, well, they checked at the Auckland office that I had enough shares in the farm to be allowed in as an owner. And I said, no, I'm also secretary for Hawke's Bay. So there were two reasons, and I'm quite entitled to go to the annual meeting. And she said, oh, she said, I'd love to come to the annual meeting. And Bernie up and says, well, you needn't think you're going to the annual meeting. You can go on the bus with all the other ladies. And it was quite rude to me. And I just said, well, I'm going to the annual meeting. Well, now, if you go to an annual meeting, half the people there are women, you know, and I sort of gradually, well, they had to accept. And then I think I was the first woman shareholder in artificial breeding. There was a good bull at down near Wellington somewhere, and they were forming a company to sell his semen. There had to be enough money in the company, and I think a South Island man, a good breeder down there, wrote and asked, would I go on the company? But I think one of the main reasons he thought, oh, well, the carters, they're in town milk, they ought to be able to afford the share of the company. But that was just another step of women being in the business side of farming. And I always did all our own book work, and I think that was when the National Council of Women gave me that.
What I'm going to do, Peggy, is just read out two certificates that you've put in front of me. One was the New Zealand Friesian Association and awarded for distinguished service to the Friesian breed, and that's Mrs. M. Carter Latona Friesians. Now the other certificate that you've just started to talk about is the Royal Aquaculture Society of New Zealand and the National Bank of New Zealand Limited certify that Peggy Carter of Napier has been recognised by her peers as a nominee for the RAS Suffrage Centennial Awards. Your commitment to your community is acknowledged in this, the century of women's suffrage in New Zealand. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that?
Let me think. Well, I think people began to realise that I was very involved in agriculture. Well, I can remember a doctor, somebody coming from Rurikura, and he came to our place. They were doing grass trials, and Dick couldn't show him where the grass trials were because we had the vet there doing a hamstring operation on a cow, and her leg had to be held up, and I wasn't capable of holding a leg up while the vet operated. So I said, I'd show this doctor whether, and he looked sideways at me. And Humphrey Jagger, who was the chief man in Hastings, he said, "It's all right, and don't look at Mrs. Carter like that. She's a farmer in her own right." And I sort of became quite well known throughout all the Friesian breed. As I say, once they didn't want to know you. You were untouchable. But after I'd been in it about 10 or 15 years, different ones, men were coming up and tapping me. "Oh, Peggy's my sister," when I wasn't their sister at all. They were glad to know you, you know. Our stud had done really well. It was one of the top producing studs in New Zealand, and we won. For 40 years, we exhibited a show and never missed a show, and we often had the champion cow, and we nearly always won the type and production class. I remember one type and production class, the first five cows all belonged to Latona Farm Limited. So I sort of became, and Dick was always behind me. He said it always gave him pleasure when some of the agents coming to sell you super or something had come up to the door and say, "Where's the boss?" And you'd say, "Down the paddock," and you'd point him out, and away they'd go. And they'd come back up and say, "Oh, Dick told me you'd have all the information I wanted to know." We had field days at our place. Once one of the stock and station agents had a field at our place, especially for stock and station agents. And one of the main things was that they mustn't treat the farmer's wife the same as just a possession like the tractors. You know, that often, well, especially now, a lot of women do all the bookwork. But in my day, if we were buying more land, it was nearly always me who went to the bank and asked for a loan. And the bank managers and that all gradually changed their tune about women in agriculture. Well, there are a lot of women in agriculture these days, and I've got a grandson who's a farm advisory officer around Palmerston North, and he called in to see me the other day, and he said he's got three widows, and he said their management's absolutely spot on, and he said he's got three sisters who milked 2,000 cows by themselves, and he said you cannot fault them. And he said most places these days the wives have a say, because farms over the years have got dearer and dearer, and usually the wife's family have put some money in, and if you've got money in anything, well, it makes you take notice, I think, and learn. And the National Council of Women and the Royal Agricultural Society, I'd sort of broken the ceiling in the agricultural world. But it wasn't easy. Men were still rude to you until they found you were making more money than they were, because they'd say, you know, "What's your quota of milk?" And, you know, and you were winning at the show. And then people began to ask you to talk at things. I remember going to the Rotary once, and of course all men in the Rotary, and I had to talk about our trip to China. And, you know, you've got to be careful what you're saying, but you don't want to be too stingy. And I remembered telling them about the toilets on the trains, how they're just in the carriages, there's just a square cut out. And I said, "It might be all right for gentlemen, but it's not very good for ladies with skirts." And I said, "There's a hole in the floor and the wind all coming up at you." And I remember a Chinaman coming up, who was in the Rotary apparently, coming up afterward. He said, "Oh, I congratulate you on being brave enough to talk about the toilets." He said, "They are just like you said." So I sort of became, well, known for kicking up a shindy, I suppose.
Peggy, do you want to tell me the reason that you went to China? Because you had sent stock over there.
you'll be getting sick of me telling me it's time to shut up.
I don't think so. You're a very interesting lady.
Is it? Well,
and I'm enjoying myself.
Yes, well, Dick and I decided to go to China just because me being boastful and saying, if I decided to go to China, I'd get there. Well, I'm a bit inclined to get my own way in most things, so I set off, and I've got a friend who's a travel agent, and I went in and saw Pauline and said Dick and I wanted to go to China and right over to Chengdu, which is in the southwestern corner of China. You couldn't get further away. And she said, oh, you and Dick always want to go to funny places. So anyway, we had to apply for a visa. And first of all, they weren't very forthcoming. As I say, it was very communistic, and they didn't like strangers coming into China. And anyway, we eventually got a visa, but they kept cutting down the time. But anyway, we got a visa, I don't know, might have been for 10 days. But at that time, the planes in China, you didn't reserve a seat. You said you were going, but you get into the plane and it's all full of people and you haven't got your seat reserved. And, you know, well, we didn't quite know what to do. So after a while, we just sat where we could find a seat, and we eventually got there. And at the time, Hastings used to own half the milk treatment, pasteurising the milk, along with the Hawke's Bay milk producers. For some reason, Napier was offered a share, but they didn't want it. But anyway, there was the chairman of the milk treatment station wrote us an introduction to the mayor of Guilin, saying Mr. and Mrs. Carter had been supplying milk for 30 years or something, and we were good farmers, and, you know, in fact, it was such a glowing report of Mr. and Mrs. Carter, I thought they must have got us muddled up. But anyway, the outcome of that was that when we got to Guilin, the mayor of Guilin put on a banquet for Dick and I. They seemed to think we were VIPs instead of just cow farmers. But anyway, it was quite interesting. And, well, you really didn't know what you were eating, but most of it tasted all right, except the big head of the banquet. All at once he said, you haven't had any of this, Mrs. Carter. And he picks up a big spoon and puts it on the plate. And I said, what is it? And he said, oh, it's, now what the devil was it? It was a snake, some sort of a snake, but it was all cut up in thin strips and must have been deep fried, I think. And I looked at the heap and I thought, how on earth am I going to eat that heap of snake? Anyway, I'm a great believer in Rome, do it as the Romans do. So I ate up the steak. And it really tasted quite nice. It tasted a bit like bacon rinds. And so anyway, they were quite pleased. He said they'd caught it specially for us that morning. And it was supposed to be quite a treat. And then when we got over to Chengdu, a Doctor Who was there to meet us at the airport and also the travel agent. But anyway, we thought we'd better go with Doctor Who. And he took us out to the New Zealand cattle. And we didn't actually see, they divided them into two lots, and one lot was further away, and that was where ours were. But we did see most of them, and they were all very, very well looked after. But all the animals in China are very small. I think, well, we thought it must be their diet. The horses are very small, and all the cattle, and that imported at one stage quite a lot of cattle from Holland, and they could never get them back into calf, and I still maintain it was their diet. Anyway, they had quite a number of girls looking after the cattle, and they were all very, very quiet. They're obviously looking after them very well. Then they had a bit of a meeting after one of our look-arounds, and they must have thought we knew more than we did, because, you know, they were asking us about why the cows didn't get in calf and that. Although I believe the New Zealand cattle have been better that way that for her, that they've got them back in Calf. But we suggested that they send some of their young men and women to Massey University, and they thought that was a good idea. And we made arrangements at Massey for our interpreter girl to come. She was very interested in the cattle, and she spoke very good English, and yes, she'd love to come to Massey. So Dick and I went, and so long ago, I forget who we saw there, but we saw the head man, and he said Hong could come out to New Zealand and have free tuition at Massey, and that was good. And there was a vet in Palmerston North, a Chinaman, Chinese, and he said if we could get Hong out to New Zealand, he and his wife would take her under their wing and look after her. Well, everything was all set for Hong to come to New Zealand and study at Massey. And then they had that Tiananmen Square disaster where they took out the tanks and rolled over the students who were crying out for democracy. Well, just at that time, America opened their gates to the Chinese students who were in the Tiananmen Square disaster, and Hong went to America instead of coming to New Zealand. But she always said she was going to come to New Zealand. And then a few years ago now, we had a letter from her saying, because we'd met up with her in Germany, she was working in a German university there, and then she'd married an American Chinese and she was going back to China. And when they'd seen her people in China, they were coming out to New Zealand, and would we send her our phone number so she would ring and we would meet them in Auckland. And that was the last we ever heard. I think there was a bit of re-education going on in China just then, and I think because they would have had democratic ideas, I think they were probably sent to one of these reformation camps to be re-educated in the Chinese way of thinking. But I wrote letters, care of her people, but never had replies. And I don't think anybody else took her place at Massey because we never heard. So
that was all quite an experience, really, wasn't it? You touched on Germany. Did you and Dick travel quite a lot?
Yes, we did. Well, I don't know why, but we seemed to, well, partly because of the Auckland office, they often send visitors to us, because I know we sort of got in, well, not actually into trouble, but the head office in Auckland got into trouble. There were people in the Waikato who'd been in the breeding years and years longer than us, but they didn't have a herd as good as us. And Mr. Roper, the National Secretary, said to me one day, he said, you couldn't send Lord so-and-so there. He said, they never put on a tablecloth. They didn't know how to set the table. He said, you can't send visitors from overseas to people who, you know, are a bit raw, if you know what I mean. I don't mean to be skitey, but, you know. So we used to get a lot of overseas visitors. Actually, a lot of my things, well, the family have got them, but I sort of shifted over here. I must have taken sick or something, because I woke up in the hospital, and then the hospital said, you can't live by yourself, it's 100 years old. And I could have. But anyway, and they sent me here. And then the family had to come in and clean out. And Diane was just saying that she thought Ian must have had, you know, a lot of the things about the Puterino school and the role and that, because I had that. Took to a bookmaker and had it all properly done and was put into the archives of the Hawke's Bay Educational School or wherever they put it. So anyway, and we used to be invited to the Royal Agricultural Show in England. We were invited to a show in Germany because the German secretary had been out to New Zealand, and the head office had said, oh, we'll call on Curtis. Mrs. Curtis, the secretary of Hawke's Bay, and they've got a good stud. So we always wrote to the German. Well, we even had a couple from Zimbabwe visit us once. They had a Holstein Friesian stud in Zimbabwe, and he had his arm blown off fighting with the Hurus, or whatever they called them. We never went there ourselves, although we had been invited, but we saw pictures. They had a very good herd of Frisians, and they had originally come from England, but they showed us all the accommodation they had for their workers. They had a special school built for the workers' children, and they had inside servants and outside, and they used to grow a lot of maize and a lot of food for Zimbabwe. But they were pushed off their farm when they started to push off all the white settlers. But Ian King, there used to be write-ups in the paper, and we used to read them, about going to the meetings and growling about them pushing everybody off, that the next thing they'd be sure to feed because there's nobody capable of growing enough food that the established farmers could produce. And anyway, all at once, we never heard anything more of him, so I think he was either shot or put in prison. No, we got to know the president of the British Society very well, and they used to invite us, and when they came out to New Zealand, they usually stayed with us. But they used to lease their farm from Lord somebody, and then when their son sort of grew up and married, their son went to Canada. I don't know whether they took their cows or not to Canada. And we went to a show in France, and I remember being on somebody's farm up in Scotland, and they'd just been to the Royal Highland show, and they had a couple of lovely cows. And if you want to know anything about the cows in those circumstances, it's better to see the herdsman rather than Lord somebody who owns them, who doesn't know one cow from the other. And anyway, you can sort of tell who's who. And I went up to the herdsman, I was talking to him, and I said, oh, that's a lovely cow there. And the cow must have thought I was quite nice, because next thing she's right up beside me and I'm patting her. And I said, well, this is a lovely cow. And he said how good she was and always. And he says, oh, lady, you do know your cows, don't you? So, oh, no, we went up to Scotland, I suppose, it was to see herds and that up there. And then one time when Dick and I just went on a tour, we went up to see the farm that my father had been on before he came out to New Zealand. He'd come out as a farm cadet, and then he'd only got out here when he went back to the war in the horse brigade, mounted horses or mounted rifles, I think they called themselves. So, oh no, I've had quite an interesting life. It's had its ups and downs, but you know, farming's an interesting career.
It's been your life, hasn't it?
Yeah, as I say, most of my life I've brought up four children and a herd of cows. and we helped Ian into his farm, he's Ian Carter. And we helped him into a farm by selling quite a few, or I don't know how many we sold. But when we had this displenishing sale to help Ian into his farm at Dannyberg, they were New Zealand record prices. So it didn't come automatically that your herd got better and better. It entailed a lot of reading about how bulls were performing in Britain, in Canada. We imported semen from Canada and the States. That, you know, you had to study, and then Dick and I'd perhaps have a discussion over, now, do you like this bull or do I like that bull? And we'd both read it up and decide which one would suit our herd better. If we had very tiny teats that were too small, well, they'd, you know, tell you what sort of udders the bulls were leaving and or what sort of feed. And of course, a lot of the farmers in those days, 50, 60 years ago, weren't very well educated. For one thing, most of the farmers had to go away to boarding school, and farming, some farms weren't that prosperous. Well, one of the bank managers told me, I suppose I must have gone to ask him for another mortgage for a bit more land or something, that in farming, there's a bigger difference between farmers' income than any other section of the community. If you own a shoe shop, if it's an ordinary, you know, everybody in a shoe shop earns practically the same, and people in a bookshop earn practically the same. But he said, not with farmers. And I know our next door neighbour, he used to get half as much milk as we did and pay twice as much tax because he never kept his books right. Because we got a grant, we had something out with the TB testing. It didn't have TB when their glands were tested. And I put in a claim for these cattle, and they said it was the best documented claim the dairy board had ever had. I had them valued by the stock agent. I worked out, we always herd tested, we knew exactly what every cow was producing. And anyway, they gave us a bit extra, but as a straight out grant, it said it wasn't to be repeated or something, I forget their height. Falutin language, but that was the gist of it. That was a donation and you weren't getting any more, so be quiet. And Hector, our next door neighbour, said, well, how did you get some money? Because they used to only pay you about $300 for every cow. Well, and most people's cows were worth more than that. And I said to Hector, well, look, I'll do your claim for you, Hector, but I'll need all the docs from the works, what you've got, and he didn't herd test, and all the, you know, dockets that would be relevant. And he says, oh, but I haven't got those dockets. I said, well, if you haven't got anything to back me up with, I said, I'm afraid I can't do you. But that was typical of a lot of farmers 60 years ago. They screwed up their dockets and put them in the shoebox, and the accountant had to
sort them out. Did you and Dick retire from the farm?
Well, we've got share milkers on, and there are sort of stabilised contracts for share milkers, the ones who own their own cows and ones that, and we had a share milker on for a good few years, and then when Dick died, I stayed on for a good while, and I only really sold up last year. Well, we'd gone from share milking into straight out lease because I'd got sick of doing the bookwork, or the GST was getting bigger and bigger. And some of the people, you've got no idea how hard it is to teach people that can't learn. And the GST was 10%. Well, Christine, her husband is a share milker, she couldn't even know how to get 10% of anything, just shifting the decimal point. And two or three years later, she said, you must have had a lot of patience trying to teach me how to do the GST. And I still had a bit. And then the last lot, they got behind with the rent. And there was a big downturn in the dairy industry. And they were behind in the rent, or further and further behind. And they owed me a good few thousand. And I thought, oh, I'm getting sick of this. And they were supposed to keep the farm in the condition they took it. Well, on the runoff, they let the yards all fall down, and I offered to buy the half rounds for the loading ramp, and they let that all fall to bits. And I reckon I lost a lot of money on the sale of that property because they let it go back. And so I said to Ian, I said, look, I'm getting sick of work, and I think I'll sell up. And Ian said, well, it's your decision. If you're sick of it, well. So that was what.
So did you sell up and come off the farm and then come into Atify?
Yeah, I bought a cottage. Well, I bought the cottage before it really sold. We had 10 acres on a separate title, and I sold that 10 acres and bought a cottage here. But I still kept the main farm and the runoff up Barkatoe Valley. Oh, no, I never minded the bookwork, you know. It never worried me. And Dick didn't like to, yet he should have been able to, because when he left, he was brought up by him and two siblings were brought up by their grandmother, because up at Puterina their mother had died, and his grandmother lived in Lower Hutt, and he lived with them until he left high school. He went to work for Levin and Co, was another stock and station agent. I don't think they ever had an office here. And he went into the part where you're learning to be an accountant. And he was learning to be an accountant. But, well, the only time was if I added up, say, the GST at morning tea time, I'd say, there you are, add up that, see if I've got it right. And he'd add it up. But he didn't like He'd rather be digging post holes. Well, he could do those jobs where I couldn't. Although I always helped in the shed, I always went for the cows and was in the shed with him and that. But his mates used to tease him and tell him he didn't need me in the shed, that he perhaps didn't, but he liked to have me there. And we were just talking about at the lunch table about one of the biggest changes, the first change when they went over to decimal currency and that, and weights, was the freezing works. Dick and I, if we're sending a cow to the works, we need to have a guess at the weight, because when you changed over from, you know, pound weight something into decimal kilos, you sort of had to turn your head around to work out what that cow might bring you. And then when we'd get the sheets from the works, we'd have a look at who was closest.
Would you say that your life has been a good one?
Yeah, I'd say overall, I've got nothing to growl about, you know. I've got enough money to live on. And well, I've never been extravagant. I never want anything. And I think that's a big help if you don't want things.
Peggy, I think we might finish the interview, okay? Yeah. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you.
Oh, well,
I mean that.
I don't know about that.
And thank you.